When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm Stephanie.
And I'm John. And this week we're talking about the Olympics and regeneration.
In the olden days, there were tyre shops, there were some knocking shops and some very dodgy pubs.
In 1983, the idea of living in an area as isolated and industrial as Nine Elms was laughed at.
It's the Olympics.
Is that you starting?
That's me starting.
Yeah, we were having some debate about how we were going to start this. I was thinking of reading out those Onion headlines that say things like, you know, opening ceremony lasts for 6 days in desperate attempt to delay. Anyway.
We could have gone with ready, set, go, starting gun.
Yeah, maybe we should have gone with, it's got a bit meta now. Maybe we should.
Welcome to our lukewarm Olympics podcast. Yeah.
I mean, we do have a fundamental, pretty structural problem here, which is that I really don't do sport. I mean, this is not a surprise to anyone who's seen a picture of me, but I don't get it. I'm missing the bit of the brain that means you can. You know those magic eye diagrams where, like, you know, there's always some people who just couldn't do it? And I'm like that with sport. I just stare at it and I just don't see what everyone else sees.
Did you enjoy the 2012 Olympics in London, though?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. I think what was really interesting about that is the way that until we got there, everyone thought it was going to be a complete disaster. I mean, that was almost the official line, is like the government was putting out these leaflets saying, oh, yeah, don't just get out of London while you still can. And, like, we got a leaflet through the door from Transport for London telling us to avoid King's Cross for the duration of the Olympics, which was difficult because it came through the door of our flat in King's Cross. But the minute it started, suddenly everyone was in a really good mood for 3 weeks. So uncharacteristic for London that just suddenly everyone was really happy and really pleased with it all. So I kind of like that aspect of it. You're giving me a look like you disagree with this.
Well, no, because I wasn't in London for the 2012 Olympics. I'd moved to London, but I was away in Switzerland. And basically what happened is every few weeks a Swiss person would come up to me and go, I was just in the city you live in. It was great. And I go, okay, thank you. I don't know, I'm here.
Did you feel like you missed out on something?
Yeah, I think so. Well, because Londoners keep telling me stories like this, but the reason I'm giving you that look is that I don't know how you would cope with 3 weeks of everyone being cheerful.
I found that easier to cope with than the sports stuff, and also it was like, okay, one of the reasons I was always quite enthusiastic about the Olympics is that it happened in an area of East London, Stratford, which that's the side of town I grew up on. And, you know, I got to see a place I knew quite well completely change over the course of 10 years. And, you know, there's all sorts of debate about, well, not really debate, it's very obvious that we massively paid far, far too much to regenerate a relatively small patch of East London. But one of the things the London Olympics did very well is that it did actually regenerate it. Like, it's not, the London legacy at least is a whole new area of the city that is now quite well used. And that's not always the case.
So what are the other, because I moved to London after, well, I moved to London right before the Olympics and then I skipped the Olympics. So I came back
You took the government's advice, basically. You got the hell out of Dodge.
Yeah, well, I just timed it timed it very badly. But I didn't kind of see that before and after. So is it markedly different to Olympic legacies elsewhere? Because I feel like every year in the Olympic opening ceremony rolls round, we get all these pictures of, you know, abandoned swimming pools in Athens and crumbling stadiums across Central Europe. And
yeah, I mean, London's sort of in the upper half of the pack. I think it's not one of the ones that everyone's pointing to and going, "Wow, this is an amazing legacy." But it's definitely not a disaster. It went quite well, even if it was probably overpriced. The city that I think is commonly agreed to have the best Olympic legacy is definitely Barcelona, which hosted the Summer Games in 1992. And what the city got right was it basically used it as a lever to fund all these big infrastructure projects it wanted to do anyway. So Barcelona, despite being the largest city on the Mediterranean coast, sort of ignored the fact that it had a coastline for you know, decades or centuries. So what one of the things they did in the Games, they completely renovated the old port area, which was just derelict warehouses, and they replaced it with, like, you know, a beach and a broadwalk and you know, really take advantage of the fact that it is this amazing cultural city that also happens to have this amazing bit of coastline. They had to import sand and all that stuff. But basically what they got right was they used the Olympics as an excuse to do a bunch of stuff they wanted to do anyway. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got Athens, where, I mean, I don't know what the hell the Athens government were thinking, but they basically spent all the money on building new Olympic facilities, like actual sporting facilities, miles and miles from anywhere. And oddly enough, once the Games have passed on, there's not really, you know, you don't have endless international Olympic festivals popping up every 6 months or so. It's all just derelict. And those are the pictures we see come around every couple of years. Because it's always, I mean, you know, to be blunt about it, there's some quite easy traffic in, like, oh, hey, here's a picture of a dead bird corpse rotting in the Olympic swimming pool in Athens. And, you know, people love that stuff.
I can see why the summer of cheerfulness might have come as a surprise to you, John. So is it mostly a case of clever use of geography then? Is that what you need to do if you want to ensure a good Olympic legacy for your city?
I mean, I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, one of the reasons Barcelona worked so well is because it was this area right next to the downtown and the central business district that had just never been used properly because it was a bit industrial and a bit abandoned. So they put a motorway underground, basically, so it was impossible to walk from the bottom of the Ramblas to the coast. But that was, it meant there was this huge area of land that's just sat there that they just never used before, so you could renovate it. And again, with London, the Stratford area is kind of surrounded by inner city, but it was this kind of industrial wasteland, but next to a station with, like, you know, six or seven different railway lines going through it. So geography is definitely a big factor, but I think actually it's planning as much as anything else.
So is it a case of infrastructure? Because obviously Barcelona is a compact, walkable city. Stratford, you need those kind of railway lines. You know, it's also about, can you just get people to where the Olympics are, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think, like, the point I'm reaching for is both Barcelona and London, the Olympics happened in an area that if there is a reason to go there, people will go there. And where it feels like Athens went wrong is they just built a whole load of facilities miles out of anywhere. So if there isn't a sporting event going on, then why the hell are you ever going to go to this place? I think there's an argument that this is a very expensive way of doing regeneration, though. I mean, like, a lot of the Stratford stuff was going to happen anyway, and they just kind of accelerated it for the Olympics. So I think there's always this value for money question over whether this is really a sensible way of funding your new light rail extension or whatever it is.
And that's an interesting question if you compare it to something like the City for Culture, because I know when we held the Olympics in London, it was very much, if you're going to do it in, you know, in the UK, you have to do it in London. Nothing else is going to be acceptable to the international audience.
I mean, that sounds slightly like it might be propaganda put about by, you know, people who live in London.
Are you admitting to something here,
no,
John?
Not,
is this,
no,
is this a confession?
No, I've always been, like, I've always been an advocate of investing far more in the rest of the country. Like, I spend a lot of time looking at maps of Manchester Metrolink too, which I get very excited by. Ooh, trams! the second city crossing. But
I remember that kind of being an argument, whether or not that is something that was true. Maybe everyone would have loved to go to Hull for the first time ever.
I mean, but this has definitely been a problem. There have been bids to host these various international competitions like the Olympics or the Commonwealth Games in other UK cities like Manchester or
Didn't
Glasgow.
Didn't Glasgow do the Commonwealth Games?
I think
Games.
Glasgow did do the Commonwealth Games. But the fact that I wasn't certain of that is kind of a helpful reminder that there wasn't the same jamboree about it that we got with the London Olympics, where it was kind of made into a national event, which I really think says something about the sort of London centrism of our national political culture, that stuff that happens in London is rammed down everyone else's throats in a way that stuff that happens in Glasgow or Manchester isn't.
Well, maybe that's something you can redress.
I'm working on it.
This is a Brooklyn-bound A Express train. The next stop is Dyckman Street. This is a 125th Street-bound A Express train. The next stop is 59th Street, Columbus Circle.
So we're now joined by somebody who knows a lot about London's Olympic Park, having worked there for a while, and also about cultural-led regeneration more broadly, and to whom I happen to be married.
Hello.
Hello, Sarah. How are you?
I am well. Did you put the cat out?
I wish we had a cat.
We don't have a cat.
We don't have a cat. We should get... Anyway, today we are going to talk about the Olympic Park. So, you know, you, like me, are an East Londoner.
Yep.
In origin. What was there before they built London's Olympic Park? What did it look like?
Stratford was home to London, in fact, I believe Europe's largest fridge mountain. That's now on Stadium Island in the middle of the new Olympic Park.
So a literal mountain of fridges.
Mountain of fridges.
Okay.
Yeah, if you can try and imagine the landscape of the Lower Lee Valley, it was a mix of industrial wasteland and post-industrial wasteland. And that's not really to do it a disservice. If we go take a little journey down Carpenter's Road, which people might remember from... watching the 2012 Olympics, you may remember the world's largest McDonald's. That was at one end of Carpenter's Road and Stratford International Station at the other end. In the olden days, it was mainly, there were tyre shops, there was a lot of scrap yards, there was some knocking shops and some very dodgy pubs. There were big piles of tyres, there were the occasional tyre fire. It was mainly 2,000 cubic kilometres of contaminated soil, which was then removed from the park as part of the process of turning into the Olympic Park.
So it was a real destination then, a kind of place you'd spend your holidays.
It depended. If you wanted to, you know, smoke some crack or get, you know, felt up on a... There wasn't even really a park bench, but there were definitely places where one could go to solicit or be solicited. But yeah, that was the main purpose of Carpenter's Road.
Stratford is on the line, the train line that used to get into town, and I always felt like... It was just like this hole in the landscape. You didn't even sort of... It's not that you were aware of this blank space. It's just you never thought of what was there because it was so, so empty. Now there's actual stuff there.
There is. And a lot of the reason there wasn't much stuff there was because of the railways. There was a lot of that land was London Continental Railway land and Network Rail land.
Freight yards, basically.
Yeah. And that was actually one of the biggest jobs that had to happen to get the Olympic Park to happen, was acquiring the land from Network Rail and London Continental Railways.
What's it like now? This area that was the post-industrial wasteland full of fridges. Can they give us a guided tour?
Okay, so you come out of the newly renovated Stratford Station and you go straight through Westfield Shopping Centre. That's the first thing that you notice. You go through a big shopping centre is on the doorstep of the park. You'll then, having cut through the retail opportunity, enter through gift shop, you will cross over large open space that you will also, where you will see cranes. You will see a lot of work happening as major structures are being built. They're building an international quarter, which is going to be like Canary Wharf, same similar kind of size that you have to traverse to get to the park. You then will notice the beautiful sweeping structure that is Zaha Hadid's London Aquatic Centre, minus the wings. You saw wings on it that looked like it was going to take off during the Games, looked like a big stingray. It's now a very elegant design. It's a municipal swimming pool. It's operated by Greenwich Leisure and is you go and swim there for £4 and local schools swim there. You then go through an area of the park, the South Park. You'll see the stadium straight ahead of you, which has just reopened.
And it's now West Ham Football Club.
It is indeed. And at that point, you're in a very landscaped bit of park, which is what lots of cities go for. I think something that you guys have covered previously, that what every city really wants is a High Line. So what the Olympic Delivery Authority did was get James Corner to design the south area of the park. So it's a mixture of hard and soft landscaping, planting, playgrounds, an amphitheatre, going down towards Carpenter's Lock, which is a disused lock, part of the London Canal Network, which is in the process of being restored with the Heritage Lottery funding. You then sweep through onto a large area of basically tarmac and urban orchard, which is Mandeville Place, which is the Paralympic legacy area, which is mainly where people are going to queue to get into West Ham Stadium, as it now is. And then you go up and through to the north of the park, which at the moment is rolling fields, landscape, bat boxes, beehives, wetlands, protected areas, and that's where a lot of housing is going to be built, you'll be pleased to know. One of the big commitments that the development corporation that now runs the park is that the commitment is to not just build giant blocks of flats, which you will see just sort of over the bridge in the former Athletes Village, which is all now posh flats, but building townhouses, things that are more in keeping with a London way of living.
One of the things I find really interesting about the park, it does feel kind of like a real place. I mean, it's very new. It's like still a bit manufactured, inevitably. But like you go there, there's people from the local community use it. There's street life. There's restaurants. It does kind of feel like it sort of worked as a creating a new bit of London.
People who are familiar with the landscape of the area, it is essentially an island. You're cut off from a lot of the world because of the railway lines, because of the river, because of the canals, and because of the A12, you're cut off a bit. And one of the big parts of the infrastructure planning was stitching the fringes, creating these land bridges into the park, and talking to the people who live at the edges of the park. The idea is that it's a place that people walk to. There's no parking, for example. There's no car park at the Olympic Park. It's not allowed. You're not allowed to drive there. It's a public transport or a walking venue. There's now hire bike stations all over the park, and that's a part of the idea, is that it's somewhere that you get to on your own steam. There's a number of free things that one can do if you are bringing a family to it. It's worked as a public space. Now, one of the things that will continue to transform over the next few years, part of the plan is to build more bloody houses, and that means getting rid of a lot of the landscape that is there at the moment. But the idea is that it would be, there will be green roofs and green walls, and there'll be wetlands and a river running through it. But what it looks like in the future as a place, it's going to look very different. It's going to be a place where people live more and more, rather than a place that ever, where you go and kick a ball around. One of the things that gets talked about quite a lot in the rebuilding of the park is things like the South Bank Centre and Festival of Britain. The idea of creating a sort of an urban playground, a place where you can engage, where you can play by means of engaging with the cultural life of London, that will happen there. The idea to build Olympicopolis, this new cultural quarter where there will be the V&A and Sadler's Wells.
That's something we had a piece on recently, actually, the parallels, which, I, being an idiot, I'd never considered before, but the parallels between what's going on in the Olympic Park and the South Bank, which was all developed for the Festival of Britain in 1951, or even going even further back, South Kensington, which is known as Albertopolis, which is all these museums and galleries and so on that were built after the Great Exhibition. And it's like, it's exactly the same thing, isn't it? It's creating a new area of a new cultural area on the site of a major exhibition.
Yes, and that's exactly the point. That's how these things happen. There is a big surge of political will to make these things happen, and it's very important to remember that no one wants these bloody things. There's a very famous George Bernard Shaw quote about no one wanting a national theatre. If you ask people, do they want a national theatre, they will say no. Give it 50 years to bed in, and people like it, they want it. And it was the same, if you remember, in the lead-up to the 2012 Games. When it was announced that we had won the bid, the very next day was 7-7. So any sense of optimism and civic pride and an idea of coming together in a celebration where we'd be waving flags in the streets had a very different connotation. We then went into credit crunch, we went into riots, we went into a period of no funding for arts, for sports. There weren't these big cultural initiatives happening outside of the Olympics and the move towards that. And part of the plan for the Olympic Games was also the Cultural Olympiad running alongside it, which meant that there was this beacon of something that was going to be happening. It was a place where there would be jobs and funding and new things in a way that wasn't really happening elsewhere. So it meant that East London was the place to be. And now that seems like a really bizarre thing to say, because of course East London's the hip happening place to be. But part of that was actually all the regeneration work, all the effort that went into creating the transport links, the infrastructure, the shops, the studio spaces for artists. All of that was part of that vision for 2012.
So it's kind of worked as a way of lighting the blue touch paper.
Yeah, it gives you an excuse and it gives you a deadline. So if you think about, like, you like transport, you're going to be better at this than I am. The things that got completed for the game. So there was St Pancras, there was Stratford International and the Javelin Line. You've got the East London, North London line, so London Overground, that all got completed for the Games.
So is the point here that, like, often these are the big cultural events are kind of used by governments as an excuse to do stuff that it's quite difficult to justify otherwise, even though it should obviously happen?
Yeah, it's things that would be nice to have, and the sheer pressure of the Olympic Games in terms of the security concerns, the number of people coming from across the world, the sheer amount of people who watch it on television. That's a hell of a deadline.
Oh, they're away, and Gatlin got away brilliantly. And
after the fanfares of the Olympic opening comes the most amazing performance by America's black streak Jesse Owens in the 100 metres.
Faultless. Absolutely faultless. Nadia Comaneci. And 10 has gone on the board.
And here comes Usain Bolt!
Okay, that makes sense. So to make politicians actually going to move on, you have to have the prospect of global embarrassment.
Yeah, I mean, Barbara wrote a piece on this. You remember Barbara? Everyone remembers Barbara. Oh, we miss Barbara. Oh. Yeah. Barbara wrote a piece on this a couple of years ago looking at the Olympic legacies, and one of the things she found out is that the Russian city of Sochi, which obviously hosted the 2014 Winter Games, there was an airport that had been that remained unfinished since 1989. It had been, you know, one of those projects, I think, that was planned in the last years of the USSR, and when that collapsed, then so did the project financing. And they finally finished it for the Games, because, like, suddenly you've got the worlds of media coming over and, like, you have to do it. So I think it is often used kind of quite consciously to kind of force people over these lines.
There is an interesting thing in that piece Barbara wrote, though, where she says, you know, sometimes you have to balance out, are you going to have the wow factor or are you going to have forward planning? And I know she says the 1984 LA Olympics, they kept it quite low-key, but that made it easier to turn it into something long-term afterwards. So maybe that's another aspect of it. You can only do one of those things brilliantly.
Yeah, I think the difficulty is a lot of the sort of the stuff of the biggest wow factor and that looks amazing in the opening ceremony or whatever isn't going to be much use to you, you know, 5 weeks later, let alone 50 years later. So, like, the Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing is being changed into, like, posh flats and shopping centre and so on. It's like they're still going to do events there, but you just never need a stadium that big ever again. Like, the Olympics, by definition, is probably the biggest thing that stadium is ever going to do. So yeah, it is, I think, sometimes quite difficult to kind of match the sort of long-term benefits with everything you need to make happen during the 16 days of the Games themselves.
So your conclusion is Olympics, inefficient, but not as inefficient as doing nothing.
I mean, no, because we've kind of, what we haven't really talked about at all is the fact that the International Olympic Committee is kind of a little bit dodgy. We've kind of managed to steer clear of that entire problem. And, like, so I think there is, because, like, particularly as, because it's so difficult to justify all this spending in a lot of developed world cities, increasingly the cities that want to host these major sporting events do tend to be in places where the rule of law is perhaps not quite as great. And so I think, you know, doing major construction projects in countries where there's issues around corruption anyway often isn't going to end well.
Oh, John, you wait until I make you talk about football. You're going to love FIFA. If you like global sporting corruption, you're going to love those guys.
Actually, I was in Doha in November a couple of years ago, and it was 30-degree heat. I was just thinking, these guys are literally going to die. people are going to die during this World Cup. So that's something to look forward to.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, on that cheerful note, moving on.
So if the Olympics are really useful as a deadline, if nothing else, then what happens if you're trying to do a regeneration scheme without a deadline? Let's have a look at Battersea Power Station.
This is Euston. Change here for Northern Line, London Overground and National Rail Service.
My name's Peter Watts. I'm a writer and a journalist, and I've just written a book about Battersea Power Station called Up in Smoke, The Failed Dreams of Battersea Power Station.
You're very proud of that title, I can tell already.
It took a while, it came right at the very end.
Well, at least it came, I suppose. So Battersea Power Station is this, it's a pretty iconic building. It's, you know, it's on the cover of a 1977 Pink Floyd album. It is one of those buildings that everyone in London sort of recognise on the skyline. But it's been sat empty for quite a long time, hasn't it? I mean, why is that?
It's sat empty since 1983, which is when it was decommissioned. And it's been a ruin for various reasons. The main one being, it's a very difficult building to do anything with. It's very, very big, and it has no sort of internal light. So there's only a limited number of things you can do with the building, whereas you can do a lot with the site around it. But no developer was allowed to do anything to the site until they'd done the building first.
Okay, so what's happening with it? Let's start with the present and work backwards. What's happening with it now? Is it currently being redeveloped?
Right, as we speak, it's owned by a Malaysian consortium. They're backed by a Malaysian sort of pension fund, so they've got quite a lot of money. So it's a state project, albeit not the British state. And they are turning it into your classic contemporary mixed-use luxury development scheme. They're building lots of flats around the power station, which they are going to sell and then use the money to do the power station itself. The power station will become essentially a very big shopping centre, but there's going to be some offices, some flats and some leisure components to it.
But they're not the first group to have attempted this, is that right?
No. I mean, it's a slightly misnomer that there have been numerous people have tried Battersea. There haven't been that many owners, but there have been about four, all of which failed for various reasons. The ones before the Malaysians were Irish. They failed because of the tanking of the Irish economy. But they essentially created the scheme that the Malaysians are building, which is the hyper-dense, very, very dense. And they were the first ones who realised that the only way you could make this site pay for itself as a commercial enterprise was by making it incredibly dense. Before then, it was owned for about 15 years by a Hong Kong developer who came up with numerous ideas. Like he wanted to turn it into a circus, he wanted to turn it into cinemas, he wanted to turn it into something that would have been a bit more public-facing. But he never really sort of, it was called Parkview, the company, and he was called Victor Huang. He never really got to a point where he was happy enough to sign off on what he was doing. And before that, it was owned by a guy called John Broome, who wanted to turn it into a theme park. He ran Alton Towers, and he saw this as being Alton Towers on the Thames.
It's sort of interesting the way the further back you go, the sort of more left field the ideas were. I think it sort of speaks to the fact that, you know, now we do just have this sort of shortage of land and housing and so on. So, like, any big brownfield site that comes up, the first thing anyone thinks is, oh, we can put some flats and offices there.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you can map the sort of preoccupations of a sort of urban developments against it. I mean, in 1983, the idea of living centrally in an area as isolated and industrial as Nine Elms was kind of laughed at. And one of the very first ideas, they had a competition to decide what to do with this building because it was listed, they had to do something. They had a competition And one of the ideas was to turn it into a luxury development with helipads and marinas and build all this nice housing. And that was rejected out of hand as being completely inconsistent with what was needed in London at that point, because what was needed was jobs. This was the 80s when unemployment was high. And the idea was that a theme park or something like that would bring a touch of kind of pizzazz to London, but also a lot of jobs.
I suppose 1983 was probably also about the sort of nadir for London's population, wasn't it? Which kind of had been falling consistently since the war.
So. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And this was not an area that people ever imagined would be an attractive place to live. You know, you're right by a railway line. It's a very isolated area. You know, it's still not particularly attractive place to live, to be honest. But such is the pressures on housing that's what it's going to become.
But also, despite being right by a railway line, it is kind of isolated, isn't it? It's off the tube.
Yes.
It's not. It's not by any sort of particularly well served.
No,
station,
this was a major drawback for all the various plans, development plans, was trying to actually get people there, because the only train station is Battersea Park, which is a quite small station. It's on the main line to Victoria, but it's quite small, and there's only really one road, and then you're kind of hemmed on by the river, and the railway line itself also blocks you. Every single developer has tried to solve that problem, and they've come up with various solutions. They've come up with bridges, and they've come up with putting in new stations. And the Irish Treasury, the group who owned it before the Malaysians, eventually said, what we need is a tube station. And that is what is happening. And that is helped by the fact the American embassy is moving very nearby. So they're putting off this spur of the Northern Line, which is, I think, the sort of first privately built tube line in London for sort of 90 years or something.
It is kind of mind-boggling that the only way they could make this development work was to effectively build their own tube line.
Yes, completely. And it's a slightly strange tube. I mean, obviously every bit of travel infrastructure is good for the city, but it's just two stations. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't connect to Clapham Junction. And I think that's a real missed opportunity.
Yeah, it points directly at Clapham Junction, doesn't it? But stops just like a mile short or something.
It's
like the busiest railway station in Britain. It seems very
I think because
odd.
They're getting the private money to pay for it, most of it, as far as I can tell. They couldn't find anyone who would pay for the final bit to go through to Clapham.
I suppose also there's probably a danger if you do go to Clapham Junction then the line is full at the very beginning, because that's such
possibly. I mean, I'm sure they've made they've done their sums, but it does make it you do kind of look at it and wonder quite what it does there.
How unusual is this situation where sort of a major iconic building sits empty for three decades or more?
It's difficult to say. I mean, I think it's, there aren't many in London is what I would say. And that's perhaps, one example to go. I mean, the problem is it was listed, and most buildings of this size and nature, industrial buildings, aren't really listed. They're just demolished, as every other power station in London has been, apart from Bankside, which is now Tate Modern.
Which has been very successful, of course. It's like one of the most successful bits of brownfield redevelopment in London's history, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when the Tate was looking for a new site, they looked at Battersea as well, but they went for Bankside because it's a lot smaller, it's a lot better located, and the fact that it wasn't listed meant that they could do a lot to it, as in build a new extension as well, which you couldn't do to Battersea.
Which, of course, has just opened a few days before we're recording this. So.
Yes, and is a very sympathetic addition to the building itself, compared to Battersea's new buildings, which are pretty ugly.
So is the problem here simply that it's a power station and it was designed to be a power station rather than luxury flats?
Yeah, I think that really is a problem. It's like listing a castle and then trying to turn that into a shopping centre or into flats. You know, it was built for a specific purpose to provide power. The only real thing, I think, looking back on it now, that they could have done is just have it as a power station that people could go and look at and just turn it into something. Just something for people to admire, like people do like looking at castles, have it as a landmark rather than having to turn it into something else. And there were various schemes along the way that kind of played up on that. There was Terry Farrell came up with a speculative scheme to turn it into a managed ruin where he was going to knock down some of the walls and turn it into a park. And his idea was then if you were inside the park, you would have still the walls around you and you'd still have that sense of scale because it is an extraordinarily big building. And if they turn it into a shopping centre, you're not going to have that sense of scale at all because you're just going to be in a branch of Gap.
Are there any examples of similar projects you've come across in your research overseas or anything that kind of made sort of pointed the way or sort of
mistakes? At various times, the different developers looked especially to America to see what was happening over there. There was a power station in, I can't remember, I think it was in Chicago that they tried to turn into a theme park, and they looked at that as an example, but that in the end failed. They looked at shopping centres as well for this kind of just this general size, but these were, you know, these were different because they were built for a purpose, as in to be a shopping centre. There aren't that many examples that I could find of buildings on this scale. There's some of the mill towns in the northwest have sort of huge factories and warehouses that have been sort of more sympathetically converted over time. So there are a few examples.
I mean, how big a problem is it that you can't just like knock windows in the thing?
Well, they are knocking windows in the thing because, you know, a lot of the problems now, you know, after 30 years, Wandsworth, the council, have had to sort of chip away at their own objections, including, you know, the fact that you couldn't, you know, that you're allowed to build on the land before you do the power station itself. So they are putting windows in, which is, you know, compromising the point of listing it in the first place. You know, they're replacing the chimneys, which is a sort of quite a major thing. At the moment, it's only got one chimney. And there's a question about whether even if you rebuild these chimneys as in exactly the same way as they were originally, is it still the same thing? They're putting grass on the roof to make it sort of prettier and nicer. These are all things that sort of compromise its integrity.
But is the development going to come off this time, do you think?
Well, it's a good question. It's a such a long-term scheme that there's going to be a lot of sort of ups and downs in the property cycles, and you have to hope they're going to ride them out. I mean, there's a real danger that if there are problems, the amount of property they're building, not just there but in Nine Elms in general, it's going to have an effect on prices at various times in the cycle, and you have to hope that the cash reserves in Malaysia and the will are strong enough, because I think if this one doesn't happen, there's a real danger that they'll just give up on the power station completely.
Well, I suppose if an organisation that has quite as much cash as the Malaysian government can't pull it off, then it's not kind of clear who can, is it? Who else is there, really?
I think exactly that. I mean, you could say that maybe what they should have done a long time ago is actually let it become a national lottery problem, you know, an English heritage problem, rather than turning it into a problem for private developers, which who have different challenges to me and different desires.
Peter Watts, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So you remember last week I did a slightly pathetic shout out asking more people to send us them talking about their city. Particularly if it's not a British city. Well, it actually worked. We've got someone talking about Singapore, which, as you'll know, is definitely not a British city. The only slight drawback is the guy doing it does have a British accent, but, you know.
My name is Jeremy Brew, and I'd like to talk about my city, Singapore. Can't talk about Singapore as a city without talking about Singapore as an island, as a country, as a nation-state, and as a political project. While Singapore has a rich history as a trading port in both pre-colonial and colonial times, it really emerged in its current form out of the turbulent period following the Second World War. It finally came into being, having been expelled from the Federation of Malay States by a unanimous vote in the Malaysian Parliament 51 years ago on the 9th of August 1965. So, by all accounts, it's a very young city and a very young country. On independence, Singapore, or at least its urban centre, was a densely populated area in the south of the island, surrounded by plantations and kampong or rural villages. The city was faced with overcrowding, slums, poor infrastructure, and lack of housing. Through the 1960s, it also faced race riots between the Malay and Chinese ethnic populations. But as I look out across the Singapore Bay today from my office window, it is hard to imagine that city in the 1960s, and how it has changed in such a short period of time to be a gleaming city of glass and steel, mixed in with a lush greenery, which earns its other name, the Garden City. The view from my office window is probably a good place in which to talk about Singapore. When I moved here as an expatriate drawn by a booming economy in 2007, I had a clear view from my office to the oil tankers dotting the Singapore Straits. Barely 9 years later, I now have to peer between at least a dozen high-rise residential and commercial skyscrapers to see the ships moored off the docks. There's an iconic triple tower building called the Marina Bay Sands, which houses one of the country's mega casinos, opened in the last few years. The port and its hundreds of dipping cranes are now no longer visible, not because of the obscured view, but as one of the world's biggest ports has moved up the coast a few kilometres, further away from the city centre. I can look down on a metro station opened last year, one of 20 such stations on an underground rail line, which was no more than a line on a piece of paper in a planning office when I arrived in the country. Giant climate-controlled eco-domes of the Gardens by the Bay, designed by Wilkinson Air as a tourist attraction and focus for appreciation in the environment within the city, were just a hole in the ground. And all of this on land which has been reclaimed over the last 30 or 40 years. The remarkable thing about so much change is the way that it has been centrally and successfully managed. And this is the same story of the country's history. If a map tells so much about a city, I would point to the four maps which accompany the Singapore concept plans. The first concept plan was put together in 1971, a joint effort between the Urban Renewal Department, the Planning Department, Housing Development Board and Public Works Department. There have been three more since then, 1991, 2001 and 2011, and each chart sets out a plan which guides the strategic land use and transportation plans for the next 40 or 50 years. Where so much urban development is part history, part happenstance, part planning and part accident, these four maps show a country and a city planned out meticulously and delivered and realised as part of integrated plans on education, economy, society. It is these which have resulted in the shift of the Singapore economy over the last 50 years through various economies from manufacturing, engineering, and now incorporate tourism, hence the casinos, theme parks, tourist attractions and the Formula One race which have come online in the time I've been here. Singapore is often criticised for a political structure which has delivered the same party to power since its independence in 1965. And in the latest election, in 2015, with 83 out of 89 seats. But it is the stability of the government which has allowed Singapore to take a long-term view of its development. What the next 50 years will deliver is unknown. When Lee Kuan Yew, the father and architect of the country and prime minister for the first 25 years, passed away last year, there was a realisation that it was an end of an era. With accelerating growth in the wealth gap, concerns amongst the population regarding immigration, affordable housing and so on, it is certainly going to be a turbulent next few years. How the city-state navigates that future and can adapt to it will remain to be seen.
Thanks to Jess for that contribution. I'm going to say again, if anyone out there, particularly people who don't have a British accent, want to contribute to this section, then get in touch.
So in the open spirit of the Olympics, we decided to do another shout out on Twitter and ask for your best Olympic stories, and specifically what sports in the Olympics do you think should not be Olympic sports, and conversely, what would you add if you could add a sport?
I did say we should talk about planning, but no, apparently we're going to talk about sports, so here we are. We got this one from Dan Anderson at Fourth Street Consultants, who says, I measure my age by the sports in which I could theoretically compete. In 2016, I'm down to shooting and dressage. Sad face.
A lot of people wrote in to say what they call horse dancing is not a sport.
People love the horse dancing. I remember this was like, Twitter was obsessed with this for like 3 days. It was like...
But it's not. I don't know if it's because you have the horse doing the work when it should be a person doing the work, but people...
It should very clearly be the horse that gets the medal, I think. And then you get into, well, if you've got a horse that was born in... I don't know if the horse was born in the US, but then raised in Spain or something. I don't know. Like, you get into all these questions about nationality. You're giving me a look like I've just been racist about horses, haven't I? I've just done horse racism. I'm talking about plastic.
I'm giving you a look like you sound like a man who could get into sport with a bit of work.
I'm always really interested in the nerdy aspects of anything, though. Like, I used to get, like...
Are you, John?
Yeah, I know, shocking, isn't it?
Rob Fuller wants to introduce the darts to the Olympics. Now, I have mixed thoughts on this because I do not care about darts in any way, shape or form. I don't trust anything done by men in short-sleeved work shirts, particularly not throwing things, but... He then mentioned you could have kind of 6 pints before you started it. And Drunk Olympics I want to get behind. So,
I mean, where does Drunk Olympics fit with the whole doping debate? Like, I mean, is lager a performance-enhancing drug?
No, I think you should get more points if you do it after a few lagers.
But when I used to play darts in the student bar, I used to not be able to do it until I'd had about a pint and a half, and then not again after about 3 pints.
Well, maybe it would depend by sport, and if you gave the horse a lot of lager, that could...
I would definitely get behind lager-fueled dressage. I think we could do that.
It's probably animal abuse, isn't it? There's one here from Ed Jefferson who says that they should add house building as an Olympic sport.
I mean, that's just someone trolling me. But Ed Jefferson wrote us a very good piece about platform numbering last week, which you should read if you haven't already. Okay, the thing I found interesting that came out of this discussion is like half a dozen people, City Metric readers as they are, told us that there used to be an Olympic gold medal for town planning.
Yeah, so Simon Alvey wrote in and said, can you discuss the arts medals awarded in the early years, particularly the time the stadium won, which obviously piqued both of our interests.
It's a bit recursive, that, isn't it? The stadium it's happening in wins a medal for itself. It's like, anyway.
All right, David Lynch. Yeah. But so we looked this up, and it turned out this did actually happen. So there was a medal for town planning, and it was won by a stadium in Nuremberg, opened in 1928 for the Summer Olympics. It was converted, so it's now a Bundesliga football club. It has gone through so many different names, but because of its great planning around the city of Nuremberg, it was given a gold arts medal in the Olympics that year.
We should probably give some context here. So, like, when the Olympics were first created by Baron Pierre de Coubertin, he'd always intended that there would be more than just sports in there, and there would be sort of arts dimensions. So there was originally Olympics literature, music, painting, sculpture and architecture. But to try and get more categories in, they started subdividing them. So for 4 different games, you ended up with Olympics and town planning, which is just crazy. Anyone out there who's of interest, that it was the Germans who particularly excelled in this sport, which took away 4 medals from those games. And this is like, you know, this is in the 30s as well. So this really raises some questions about what was going on with the town planning category there.
Yeah, genau. So we have 1928.
Oh yeah, that's
that's fine. But then yeah, Berlin does win again in 1936.
Yeah, and you kind of think of the people who were doing the town planning in Berlin in 1936, and it gets a bit dark.
Well, I do have to say this Frankenstadion in Nuremberg was, you know, very effectively reused, in that it was used as a National Socialist marching area, and for the 4th Deutsche Kampfspiele, which is this kind of Nazi sports body event. But it's now just used by a Bundesliga club, which is a much happier legacy.
That is nice.
I'm hugely pro Winter Olympics, by the way. I think the Winter Olympics are better.
Okay, do you want to explain that?
I think they have better sport, because I think skiing is very entertaining to watch, and I like people jumping off things, although this may be because I saw Eddie the Eagle last week, so I'm currently really into ski jumping. Also, I think curling is one of my favourite Olympic sports, because it is basically mopping the floor aggressively, which I enjoy.
It's like the Olympic medal for street cleaning. It could all be around city planning. Okay, you're really going to have to stop because looks do not make good radio. This is the thing you're going to have to learn. It's like, as withering as the look is.
Maybe I can just say, you know, every time you make a joke about
you just go
city planning,
withering look.
Yeah, so. I'll get a kind of thing like, yeah. I'm a radio announcer. But yeah, I genuinely believe that the Olympics should be both as banal and as scenic as possible. So the Winter Olympics for me works much better. We did get a great tweet coming in from Sasha Fernando.
I love Sasha. What's Sasha got to say?
So he says the Olympics should be more objective. So we should have heaviest runner, longest javelin, most dives, loudest dressage. So
there were a couple of people who sort of popped up to say that, like, they didn't believe in any Olympic sport where there's a jury of judges.
Yeah, so gymnastics isn't allowed to count because it's not objective.
Like long jump, like you can tell who's jumped the longest, but like, you know, how good was the horse dancing? You know, like,
I mean, I have some sympathy for that, but obviously, because, you know, I'm from a northern household, I do think Torvaldsen to Bolero is the best Olympic moment that has ever existed. So I will.
Well, moving swiftly on from that. Okay, just to wrap up, one of the things I do genuinely quite like the Olympics for all the sort of wasted money, for all the dodginess, for all the fact that it's like this hotbed of yeah, it's a complete mess, isn't it? But one of the things I really like about it is that it is a global event, and it's one of the sort of few times where, you know, the whole world comes together around something. And that is kind of awesome. But it's a way of doing that without having to spend billions of dollars, like, redoing some roads in forlorn bits of cities somewhere in the world every few. Like, is it worth trying to find another way of doing this, do you think?
Are there kind of alternative models that people have proposed?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Yeah, so there are people out there who suggest that either we should just commit to doing it in the same city every year, which, like,
I'm not happy with that at all.
No, you're doing another one of your looks. But I mean, like, the city that gets mentioned a lot is obviously Athens, because that's it was Athens that had both the original sort of games in the 5th century BC and then...
No, I'm not okay with this. First of all, Athens have already shown their inability to run Olympics. Yeah. They're completely out. Yeah, no, that's ludicrous.
Okay, do you have other objections?
Yeah, well, I quite like the idea that you move around different cities and you get the... I realise I'm sounding like the Carl Pilkington of the Olympics here, but I like the idea that you go and kind of... You are forced to encounter a different city every 4 years. You have this global spotlight on somewhere else and you're able to put across something of the national culture. And that, to me, is quite exciting. Impractical, but
yeah.
Fun.
No, I take your point. Okay, the other options that get discussed are... You could break it up and maybe rotate it around four or five cities. So you could just pick four or five cultures you want to display. So they all get like a go every 20 years. So like maybe one on each continent.
One on each continent. Okay. I mean, it's better.
Or the other one is you do a kind of disaggregated Olympics where... So you do like the big opening ceremony is in... And like maybe the athletics are in like a particular city every 4 years. But other sports can happen in the same... city every year, so like maybe Olympic tennis would be at Wimbledon every 4 years.
I don't know, but wouldn't that create a problem for audiences travelling to it, because you have people who do kind of go, I'm going to go for the whole... I think you're not a sports fan, John. I can see you're already kind of going, you have no empathy with the person who... Yeah.
I mean, like, and then, like, go and watch, like, all the sport. I mean, it's not, it's bad enough that you want to watch sport, but, like, you want to go and watch all the sport?
But I wonder if people who are into the Olympics kind of go, you know, I want to go and watch the whole season of it and all the different stuff. And
yeah, but that's a very small number of... That's a tiny share of the global 1% there, isn't it? It's like the vast majority of the people who engage with the Olympics, which is, you know, billions of people probably, are watching it as a global media event. And, you know, in this age of 24-hour broadcasting, does it really matter where the sport is being beamed into your house from, as long as it's kind of all happening?
Yeah, it is interesting, and I guess then you can... That would solve my quibble with the geographical aspect getting boring. If you go, you could have 100 cities in every Olympics. More cities.
More cities is always a good idea. I think that's the lesson here.
Okay, well, if they can restructure it in time for the next one and this podcast is still running, we can...
Yeah, if anyone wants to sponsor us to do a live outside broadcast from...
Everywhere.
Then get in touch. You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by John Elledge and Stephanie Boland and produced by Royfield Brown. You can contact all three of us on Twitter, where there's a pretty good chance we'll talk back. Our theme music was Waves by CORTR. You also heard Wheel One by Vixento. All music in the show was licensed under Creative Commons. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast, on iTunes, or in the podcatcher of your choice. You can also find two more shows by Eric and colleagues, Seriously and the New Statesman podcast. In the meantime, you can find all the stories about cities, maps, and geography you could ever possibly want on our website, citymetric.com. And since you've listened this far, leave us a nice review on iTunes, eh? Go on. We love you for it. Thanks for listening.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
지하철역입니다. 내리실 문은 오른쪽입니다. 명도 한국이나 사람
the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.